I'll call the meeting to order, and we're going to do two completely separate things today. One is get an overview so we can understand what the governor's proposal is on GAMC, on auto enrollment into Minnesota Care. We'll hear from the commissioner and George Hoffman, and then the Hospital Association will also weigh in on that issue. Then we're going to go to the governor's supplemental budget and get sort of a brief overrun, and keep all your spreadsheets for that one, because we'll be looking at them many times in the next couple of months. I have an introduction to make. We have some people from the Central Minnesota Area Health Education Center, which is in, is that your district, Painesville? And Representative Otremba is a member of that group. And that is an education center that involves the University of Minnesota plus the local healthcare providers. And we have Steve Moberg here and Dr. Ron Verant. I don't know if they're around or there. So thank you for coming to watch this, and could be an interesting meeting. So with that, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Ludeman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the invitation to be in front of the committee and committee members. I appreciate it. We're going to talk briefly about the decision to auto-enroll current GMC enrollees into Minnesota Care. GMC, as you know, was line item vetoed by the governor last May. That was a $381 million veto, a line item veto, and we have contemplated since then. I could have broke it all by myself. Excuse me. So what we have been able to do is use the door of transitional Minnesota Care to transition and automatically enroll GMC, current GMC enrollees on April 1st into Minnesota Care. That transition Minnesota Care proposal means that for 2, 3, 4, or 5, or 6 months, the counties would be obligated to pay the premiums, the Minnesota Care premiums, for those enrollees for that period of time. And then those enrollees would have to apply and successfully enroll in Minnesota Care subsequent to that enrollment. That is where their coverage would exist. That is the benefit plan for which they would receive benefits, and that is how payments would be made. That is conditional, of course, on the continuation of the payment of those premiums for their continued enrollment in Minnesota Care. In a real brief nutshell, Mr. Speaker, that Mr. Chairman, that is what it is. As you know, the Minnesota Care benefit set difference, the biggest difference with it is that there exists a $10,000 inpatient hospital payment cap in Minnesota Care. And that has been a point of contention about what effect that might have on any one or all Minnesota hospitals for that payment of those larger claims beyond $10,000. That is what we continue to intend to do. And as we put out bulletins to county or human service organizations about how they can successfully enroll this and then notice the enrollees themselves, is what we're busily preparing to do.
Commissioner, is Mr. Hoffman going to testify? Or?
Yes, he's here.
Okay, I'll save my questions for him.
All right. George Hoffman is the DHS forecaster.
I have another announcement. AFSCME Council 5 from Duluth is in the green shirts around. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, George Hoffman, Department of Human Services.
Are you going to run through your spreadsheet? Because I know the hospitals have a different spreadsheet than we. We just received a copy of the hospital runs from your department yesterday.
Mr. Chairman, we appear to have dueling spreadsheets here. The The main reason why DHS put out a spreadsheet was to add an element that the Hospital Association did not have in their spreadsheet, which is that that hospitals are going to get substantial payments from MinnesotaCare, that for the people who would have been enrolled in the GAMC program, many of whom will be enrolled in MinnesotaCare instead. And so we showed a column that showed that was based on an estimate that in the 16-month period in question in the GAMC bill, our estimate was that the hospitals would get $114 million in inpatient and outpatient payments. And we showed a distribution of that amount. The distribution was based on the distribution of GAMC hospital payments in calendar year 07. And that was essentially the reason that we provided that information, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, if I may?
Yes. Commissioner.
I have some culpability here. In my conversations with the Hospital Association about 10 days ago, in the columns of the spreadsheets, not to get into a spreadsheet war, as Mr. Hoffman said, is that the Hospital Association said that their assumption of no GAMC was as if there were no enrollment into MinnesotaCare. So that spreadsheet interpretation was that. They said that. I thought that a more useful presentation would be something different than that. I did not actually put into action any spreadsheet preparation until some legislators asked for that specific information for hospital-specific spreadsheet information.
Well, they're going to make a presentation where they do the hospital runs and the total hospital, what they feel is going to happen.
Sure.
And Mr. Hoffman, if I could ask you a couple of questions. So you're going to, what happens, I mean, I understand the people that are in the system now, and I'm not concerned about that, but what happens on April 1st when the cops in Minneapolis find some disabled vet under a bridge, and the person is homeless, and they take him to Hennepin County? What is Hennepin County Hospital going to do on April 1st to enroll this person in something? Because my understanding is there is no transitional GAMC because it was defunded.
Mr. Chairman, with the funding ended for the GAMC program, there will be no same-day eligibility available for that person.
And how long would it take that person to be enrolled in MinnesotaCare then?
If it's the typical time frame, it would be 1 to 2 months, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Hoffman, my understanding is taking about 4 months right now. So this person would have no insurance for 1 to 2 months, is what you're saying?
That's my understanding, Mr. Chairman.
And so the hospital would have to eat the cost on that?
That's correct.
And is that in your forecast or your spreadsheet?
It's implicit in the forecast, Mr. Chairman.
And what would happen, let's say, another individual on January 1st of this year lost his job because he had a mental breakdown and ended up on the street, but he had insurance in the job. He lost his job, lost his health, lost his home, but he had insurance on January 1. What's going to happen to him on April 1st? He has no money, he's destitute, on the street, mentally ill. what will happen to that individual that the Minneapolis or the St. Paul department takes him to Regents Hospital. Now, he had insurance starting on as of January 1, but then he lost his job, lost his insurance. What's going to happen to him on April 1st?
Mr. Chairman, he won't have any other same-day coverage either.
Will he still have the 18-month limitation that before he gets on to Minnesota Care?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman. I think maybe the fact that he's lost the job gets him out of that.
Well, I'll ask Mr. Chen about that later.
Mr. Chairman,
have an answer, okay. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, Karen Giusto, Department of Human Services, the answer to your question. We are going to be flowing all of our new applicants on or after April 1st through the same transitional Minnesota Care door. So the barriers that apply to regular Minnesota Care, the four-month insurance barrier, that ESI barrier, they don't apply to the transitional Minnesota Care program. So that person who had other health coverage and then lost it, they would be enrolled in that transitional Minnesota Care program, and then when they get to the end of their six-month period, then they would be renewing coverage and potentially enrolling in regular Minnesota Care. And it's at that point that the insurance barriers and premiums would apply to that enrollee.
How are you going to enroll people into a program, transitional Minnesota Care, that is not funded?
Well, the transitional Minnesota Care includes a GAMC portion of a few months in the beginning, which are funded under general fund, followed by the Minnesota Care Healthcare Access Fund portion. That portion is still funded. And so, as Mr. Hoffman had said, folks will not have same-day eligibility because that would be funded under the general fund. They will have prospective eligibility under a managed care plan with the Minnesota Care benefits set with county-paid premiums for the balance of the six-month eligibility period.
So on the gentleman on April 1st is what you're telling me, then he would not be eligible for Minnesota Care until May 1st.
Mr. Chair, yes, I believe that's correct. They would be covered upon managed care enrollment.
And Mr. Hoffman said that enrollment period could take 1 to 2 months.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's generally correct. We generally give folks 30 days to choose a health plan, so it depends on the timing of their application and how long they have to choose a health plan.
And how long does it take right now for you to process the paperwork for somebody that's not on general assistance medical care to get them, get that family signed up for Minnesota Care?
Well, Mr. Chair, the process that we are talking about with transitional Minnesota Care occurs through our local county agencies. It is different. It's a different enrollment process than for regular Minnesota Care, which the vast majority of those applications flow through our state Minnesota Care operation. So for these folks who are coming in who would have been enrolled in GAMC, their experience as far as their application processing should really be no different than it is today. The county agencies are going to continue to process their eligibility. Instead of for GAMC, they'll be processing their eligibility for the transitional Minnesota Care program.
Thank you. And any other questions? I have Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for Ms. Giusto. Hi, how are you? The auto enrollment plan set forth by the administration covers up to 6 months, and the commissioner covered that, so for 1 month or 2 months or 3 months. So if someone is currently being served in general assistance medical care, and maybe they were determined or they presented at the hospital and got enrolled in November, and they're, or December, say. So, you know, they've been in December, January, February, March, April. Their auto enrollment will only last for a month. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yes, it is based on, they're going to get the balance of their six-month eligibility period. So if they have a renewal in 5 months, they'll get 5 months. If their renewal is scheduled for 3 months, then they will get 3 months. It's the balance of that six-month period for current enrollees.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy.
I think, you know, we've been working on some, you and I and others have been working on some simplification. And this is, a level of complexity in terms of determinations and eligibilities that, and I know you're working with the counties, but I am not sure the systems that we have in place right now, you know, the computer systems that we have, et cetera, are sophisticated enough or modern enough to be able to handle this. Are you concerned about or working on any sort of contingency to make sure that there's clarity about who's supposed to be where and when? Because I think we've talked about this two or three times, and it's still pretty confusing for those of us who are pretty up to speed on how this works. So I'm just wondering if you think there's clarity about this process unfurling across the state, or if it's going to be sort of chaos unleashed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, one of the reasons why I believe that this will be successful in moving people to transitional Minnesota care is actually because we're doing it right now, where the counties are already familiar with this process. They are moving people from GAMC when they become ineligible for GAMC. They move them through transitional Minnesota care. So I think that there is a level of kind of, there might be a level of confusion or mystery in the general public around how this program works. But in fact, we've been operating transitional Minnesota care now for several years. It is very complicated, but I do have faith in our county agencies that they will be able to do this because they're doing it right now.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Gusto, just one more question then. After the 6 months has elapsed, so then we're just going into regular Minnesota care, and people are going to fill out their applications and wait to be determined eligible, et cetera, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it actually follows the current process. At the end of your six-month period for transitional Minnesota care, you get a renewal. The folks to who this is going to happen to are going to get the same renewal they get today. When they get to that renewal, the county agency determines eligibility for regular Minnesota care. And it's at that point that the county agency retains responsibility for that case, but they enroll them in the regular Minnesota care program based on their renewal.
And let me ask a question. And if the person is homeless, is the social worker going to go check under the bridges to give him his renewal notice?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that the renewal notices are not any different than they are today. So folks would get a renewal at the end of that six-month period. It's just going to be a renewal that is then determined for regular Minnesota care. So I think the folks that fall through the gaps are going to continue to fall through those gaps. It's really no different than what happens today with regard to paperwork. Folks are not going to fill out additional paperwork to make this transition.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, and this is a productive dialogue, I think. I know my county is doing this SMRT thing that they, is that the process where they do some of this expedited, they've added some staff and they're trying to gear up for this. I know they were talking about that. And when the, just to help this clear, so when they appear and they put their head in there at the hospital, there's a, if there was money, they would have got, the hospital got money for the first month or month and a half, but now they're enrolled, but there's no money to pay for that. Then they get in the PMAP thing, and then they have 4.5 or so months of care, of paid services, if I got that clear. And then at the end of the 6 months, would there, in most cases, is there no gap in coverage when they get from transitional to regular Minnesota care?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, there may be a gap in access. There's not a gap in coverage. When folks move from transitional Minnesota care to regular Minnesota care, if it takes too much time, they can get retroactive coverage to fill in the gap. So there, ideally, there is no gap. But if for timing purposes there creates a gap, they are eligible under state law for retroactive Minnesota Care.
And so so my county, which had 1,200 people in transitional Minnesota Care, when they would, those would be moved to regular Minnesota Care after they're through the transitional program, is that correct? Just to understand it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, yes.
Thank
that's
you.
Correct.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gusteau, what is retroactive Minnesota Care?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
What is retroactive Minnesota Care?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, what that is, and it's in Minnesota Care statute, is that if someone is moving directly from MA, medical assistance, or GAMC, or transitional Minnesota Care, and they're moving directly into regular Minnesota Care, if they if they pay their initial premium within 30 days, they will then get an optional premium, which closes the gap if there are any retroactive months. They can choose to take that coverage, or they can choose not to if they didn't have any services during that time.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just one more question.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks. When we got the forecast, and maybe this is a question for somebody else, but when we got the forecast, the prediction for the use of Minnesota Care for the GMC population was coverage of about 28,000 people. Is that still the number you're using?
28,000, did you say?
28,000.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, 28,000 is approximately the number of people we expect to be transitioned to Minnesota Care at the point that the program ends.
Thank you.
And if someone could add, where in state law does it say retroactive? The way I read the law, it says you have to be on general assistance medical care before you can get the retroactive Minnesota Care.
Mr. Chair, I'll have to look back at that. Currently, folks who are moving from any of our other programs, MA, GMC, transitional Minnesota Care is actually GAMC followed by Minnesota Care under the statute, and so it is. Folks are eligible for that retroactive coverage as they move between those programs, but I can take a look at that piece of statute for you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just talk mechanically, if folks right now that are on general assistance medical care, these 28,000 folks, are scheduled to move into Minnesota Care on April 1st, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, they're going to move into transitional Minnesota Care, which is Minnesota Care under the law with county paid premiums.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Dean,
the folks won't have to fill out any paperwork. They'll automatically be signed up and moved over on April 1st into transitional Minnesota Care. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct. They don't have to do anything.
Mr. Chair, and could you talk just a little bit about, I think there's some issues with retroactivity and with folks falling off. If I'm on General Assistance Minnesota Care and I'm being moved over into transitional Minnesota Care on April 1st and I'm not following the news, how would I know that that's happening?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are doing it systematically. So everyone who's identified on this program, the system is going to automatically convert. We're sending out notices to enrollees, and then also they will get notices about the change in benefits as well. So we've really tried to, in as much as possible, provide notices that are going to give people the information that they need. They can also, you know, once they are enrolled, they can contact their health plan for help with regard to their notices. And also we have a member help desk at the department that can also help people navigate what their benefits are.
Mr. Chair, just a final question. Just so we understand that these folks are moving across, they don't have to apply, they're being reminded of what's going on and updated from the department, they're moving into transitional Minnesota Care, that's all good. when they are in transitional Minnesota care, they can draw down from general fund dollars through that source. Is there anything in current law being the unallotment and moving forward, is there anything in current law that would change the ability of transitional Minnesota care going into the future to draw down any dollars from the general fund, or will that mechanism continue?
Ms. Kolchajoy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that the transitional Minnesota care that we're using to move people into regular Minnesota care is funded out of the Health Care Access Fund and not the general fund. So when we are moving these GMC enrollees on April 1st into the Minnesota Care program with county paid premiums, that is under the Health Care Access Fund.
Okay, I have a couple of questions. One for you, Ms. Kolchajoy. How is someone that's making less than $8,000 a year going to come up with a $1,000 deductible in Minnesota care?
Mr. Chair, I think that you are referring to the $1,000, which is a 10% copay on inpatient hospital. So it applies when someone is receiving inpatient hospital services. It's not an across-the-board deductible. It only applies to those inpatient services under Minnesota care.
So every time they go to the hospital, they'd have to come up with $1,000 out of their $8,000. And most of them, by the way, are only making a couple thousand.
Mr. Chair, I'm watching the audience there. It is $1,000 per year maximum. So if you had several hospitalizations, you would not have an obligation of more than $1,000. And it's 10%, so it's based on your hospital charges.
Okay, then I have a question for Mr. Hoffman. You're estimating there's going to be 21,000 people on this program?
An average of 21,000 for the 3 months, April, May, June of 10.
And what's your forecast after that?
After that, it's
because right now I think we have about 35,000.
It's in the longer term, Mr. Chairman, we're expecting that the average Minnesota care enrollment of this GAMC group will be about half of what the enrollment would have been under GAMC.
And what happens to the other half?
The other half is partly, largely, the other half is the half that would have had immediate coverage or fee-for-service coverage under GAMC, or fee-for-service transitional Minnesota care coverage under GAMC. So from a forecast perspective, Mr. Chairman, it's just part of the population remains covered and part of the population is not covered.
So the hospitals then, if these people show back up in the emergency room, would have to eat that cost again?
There would be no source of payment for that, Mr. Chairman, unless the person is able to qualify for, say, medical assistance, which can happen sometimes, but can't be counted on to happen very frequently.
Okay. We're going to have to move along a little quicker here, but Representative Abler and then Representative Hodge.
Thanks. I'll just settle for a question from Mr. Hoffman. I think the hospitals are coming up later to describe their spreadsheet. Have you looked at, just so we don't have to ask the question then, it seems like you're off by a factor of two. Can you explain that?
They've done an independent forecast of what's going to happen, and the forecasts are quite different.
Okay, thank you. And just one more short question. And just to make it clear about what your forecast is even counting the people who walk in without coverage for that month and a half, that's implicitly figured in here. So this counts the net money to the hospitals after the 4.5 and 6 month time. Is that just to, I think you said it before that way, but just to, the hospitals get 107,000 or a million, I mean, over the course of the 16 months, even counting the month and a half with no money.
Mr. Hoffman.
We're the 107, let me see what's the 107 million is our estimate for the 16 months of the amount that we think would be paid to Minnesota to Minnesota hospitals out of Minnesota Care for this population.
Thank you.
Representative Hosh, and then we're going to go to the Hospital Association.
Mr. Chair, I just had one question because of assumptions that we've been operating under with the transitional Minnesota Care, and then after the 6 months moving on to traditional Minnesota Care. Are those assumptions including if the governor's budget were to pass, or would things be different if the governor's budget passed? I know the governor's budget's a different time on the agenda, but I think they're not independent of each other.
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hosh, the governor's budget proposes a cut to Minnesota Care eligibility that would bring it down to the GAMC income level, which is 75% of poverty. So to the extent that the same income level is still covered, this group, to the extent they remain at the same income level, would still be covered. Numerous other people would lose Minnesota Care eligibility.
And Mr. Hoffman.
So it would be offset somewhat.
Oh, the commissioner is pointing out there would be some additional hospital payment reductions in the governor's budget, which would make the hospital payment number somewhat smaller.
And how many people are going to be laid off or removed from Minnesota Care on October 1st when you're going to 75% of poverty? How many people will lose their health care?
Approximately 28,000, Mr. Chairman, at that point.
And did you include the fact that they will no longer be able to pay hospitals in your hospital run?
I'm not following the question, Mr.
Chairman.
Well,
there's 28,000 people are going to be without health insurance on October 1st. Some of those people will still get sick. Some will go to the hospital. What's going to happen to them? And they're probably not eligible for.
I understand the question now, Mr. Chairman. The hospitals will get paid a lot less if those people lose their eligibility for Minnesota Care, and that is not accounted for in the spreadsheet we gave you.
Well, thank you. Now we'll hear from the Hospital Association. And Mary, would you state your name for the tape?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'd like to start out, if I can, with just a couple analytical comments that really don't have to do with the underlying policy, but I think they're important to point out as we talk about these sort of dueling spreadsheets, and so I think that it's important for folks to understand. I think it's important to note that these spreadsheets are a snapshot in time, that you have to be careful to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples and not apples to oranges. And I'd like to give you an example of that, and that is the Mankato Hospital. And if you look at on the spreadsheet that was distributed by the Department of Human Services, and you look up hospital number 72, which is Emmanuel St. Joseph's in Mankato, And you can see that Emmanuel St. Joseph does worse under the Hospital Association or the proposal by Representative Murphy and her bill right now regarding the payments. And they do better under the DHS proposal of MinnesotaCare. I think it's important to note that the Department of Human Services used hot-off-the-press numbers regarding the percentage of GAMC payments. And we had data that was a year older. So under our model as well, Mankato Hospital would get paid more money because they have a higher percentage now of GAMC patients. So you have to recognize that all of these numbers are a snapshot in time. And the important thing for hospitals is that we maintain coverage for this population because you never know where somebody is going to show up. So the fact that one hospital does a little better under one column or does a little worse under another column, a lot of it has to do what percentage you're using and what snapshot in time you're choosing to look at, okay? So right now, given that Mankato has more GAMC business than they used to have, they would still do better under our model, okay? So it's just the snapshot that we chose to use. That's the first analytical comment. The second one is regarding the formula. What the Department of Human Services did is they're taking a dollar amount and plugging it into what percentage of business you have in the GAMC program. We decided that it would be more fair to look at what percentage a hospital has of its net patient revenue in the GAMC program. Let me give you another example. The Bemidji Hospital, if you did this formula based on what percentage of GAMC they are of the whole program, they're 1.44%. But it represents 3% of its net patient revenue. So what we were trying to do is we were trying to put a little bit more money to those hospitals that had a higher percentage of their overall GAMC business was in MinnesotaCare. Quite frankly, you could do the formula either way, okay? We made a decision to try to help those hospitals that had a little higher percentage of GAMC business. It doesn't mean that one is right or wrong. We just thought that it would be more fair to help those hospitals that served higher percentages of GAMC patients. Now for the more important part of the discussion, if I can, I'd like to talk about the policy decision of moving this population into MinnesotaCare versus keeping it as a standalone GAMC program. The issue really comes down to continuous coverage. Continuous coverage is the heart of the issue. We took the numbers from the November forecast, and if these numbers are updated, we will certainly change our spreadsheet. But the numbers that we have from the November forecast, they are estimating that there will be 21,913 individuals, 21,913 individuals moved into MinnesotaCare from the GAMC program for 4 months. And whopping number drops off in 2011. It drops down to 15,274 people. So for all of 2011, that number drops down to 15,000. So what is the amount of coverage? What are we really buying? How many people would be in MinnesotaCare? It comes down to continuous coverage for that population. Under Representative Murphy's bill, she has 38,000 people enrolled for 16 months. So under that formula, then, she is covering folks in members per month. And that's the way, this is the sheet that I'm referring to on the back of the hospital chart. On the back of the hospital chart, and I'm sorry, I probably jumped ahead on this, but it's really important to look at the difference in the coverage and how long people are in the program. So what we've done is we've taken the exact amount from the November forecast and looked at how many GAMC enrollees would be moved on to MinnesotaCare and how many months they have coverage for. So under the governor's proposal, you would have 87,000 member months for 2010, and then for 2011 you'd have 183 member months for a total of 270,000 member months. And under the Murphy bill, you're buying coverage for a longer period of time and for more people. So then you'd have coverage for 38,000 people for 16 months for a total of 616,000 member months. So now we look at the payment and why we believe the payment is significantly less. If you look at how much the payment would be, the department just chose a number, and they said that is how much they would put into the Minnesota Care Program. They did not take into consideration the $10,000 cap or the copays. So what we got was we got information from the department regarding the fee-for-service program, and they told us that there was $17 million worth of care above the $10,000 cap in the fee-for-service portion. We made an assumption, and I have to admit that this is one of our assumptions, we made an assumption that the PMAP portion had the same amount of care above the $10,000 cap as the fee-for-service portion. And if the health plans can provide more updated information, we would certainly change that number. But we have calculated then a loss of $34 million in payments because of that $10,000 cap. And exactly like the department testified a minute ago regarding the $1,000 copay, we have already stated in our assumptions that half of the people don't need hospitalization. Quite frankly, we think the GAMC population probably all accesses hospital care at some point in time, but we're willing to say that half of them don't. We're willing to say that half of them get their care just exclusively in clinics or through physician offices and aren't seeking hospitalization. So we've deducted another $11 million out because of the $1,000 copay that hospitals would not receive. So we are estimating that hospitals, under the governor's proposal, would receive approximately $51 million in payments, where under Representative Murphy's bill, we're estimating that hospitals would receive $134 million worth of payments. So obviously, for an individual hospital, looking at those numbers, obviously $134 million is better from the hospital's perspective than $51 million. But it's also about the coverage for people. And I think the department today, in their testimony, kind of alluded to, once they're done with their 6 months eligibility paid for by the county, it gets a little squishy as to whether or not they have coverage or not. So this is why we believe that the standalone GAMC program is significantly better for this population. It really comes down to about four things. Number one, are the premiums going to be paid? Can they stay in the program? Number two, are the copays waived? Number three, what about that first episode of care, as Representative Huntley alluded to? What about somebody who comes into the emergency room? Are we going to be able to enroll them on the spot? And the fourth item is the $10,000 cap, as we've talked about. So from the hospital perspective, those four items, the premium, the copay, that first episode of care, and the $10,000 cap, is why a standalone GAMC program is better for the individuals that it serves as well as for the hospitals. And we're willing to live, obviously, with the payment cuts and recognize that this is only a 16-month program, but it is a better program for us than the Minnesota Care program is. So, thank you.
Questions for Ms. Krinke. Representative Abler.
Thanks. I just have one. Could we last year there was some spreadsheets running around that the department didn't have the same credibility in that you had from the Hospital Association. Here again, we have two spreadsheets. And I don't want to question either of your intent, but can you, between now and the conference committee, this, go sit down with the department and figure out one that you both agree on? Thank you. It's a comment, not a question.
Representative Huntley and Representative Abler, there are a couple assumptions on this sheet that I think are important. One is the amount of care above $10,000. We got the number for the fee-for-service component. We do not have the number for the PMAP component. So that number may not be $34 million. Also, the number regarding the copays is an estimate as well. So admittedly, there is a little wiggle room in these numbers, but we think the $51 million is a much more accurate account. So,
any other questions?
I don't
Okay, seeing none, thank you, Ms. Krinke. And we're going to move on to the budget presentation. But I understand that the people from the Central Minnesota Area Health Education Center have just arrived, and welcome them to the committee. And is Mary Ellen here? No, I don't see her. She must. So welcome to the committee. And Commissioner Ludeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. I would have a lot of comments about the last subject, but we'll reserve those for another day and place. You have asked, just want to get this started off in the right direction, Mr. Chairman. You have asked for a general overview of the governor's supplemental budget. I assume that meant... Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. We have a... Has this been spread? For purposes of discussion, I have... There's actually 48 issues, 48 items that would actually have to be discussed if we drill down to every detail. I don't know if you want to schedule that much time this afternoon or not.
Not this afternoon.
So we'll... I have put those in sort of categories of reductions. Now, this is everything that we have done from the governor's office to make a supplemental budget proposal that reaches us toward the resolution of a $1.2 billion deficit. You should know that we have tried very hard not to affect some of the core safety net services that we are able to pay for or provide, but that we are stretching to a large degree, by affecting recipients, providers, and the agency itself to a large degree and to an imperfect degree. But with that said, I am going to just go through the one-page legal-sized document that has all on one sheet these 48 items, and I will not talk about each one of them, Mr. Chairman, but I think there are some obvious highlights of this proposal that can be talked about.
For the members, we're going to go over this in more detail on the 24th and 25th.
But you will see that we've categorized these in certain categories against both the health care side and the human service side. How some of these savings are proposed to be affected. Well, first one, the big one that is talked about quite a bit and will be talked about quite a bit, I trust, is eligibility reductions. This has a direct effect on how many people would be eligible for either health care or human services. The very first one I need to talk about is called Convert General Assistance. Basically, this is an elimination of general assistance, a recreation of a crisis general assistance, and a retention of personal needs general assistance payments for those in temporary or long-term residential facilities, not only state-operated but in the private sector as well. The $203 monthly grant, however, is ended for that cash assistance. This does affect a considerable number of Minnesotans, 16,200 that we forecast would be directly affected, to affect a $14 million savings, or 13.7. Mr. Hoffman made some reference to the governor's proposal that reduces Minnesota Care eligibility for adults without children to 75% of FPG. As you know, adults without children have not and never have in Minnesota received a Medicaid match. This is state-only appropriations, whether it be in GAMC, for example, or Minnesota Care. These are not matched funds. This eligibility maintains at least up to the GMC population eligibility for that. Over the last course of 3 or 4 years, that eligibility has risen from 200 to 215, and then from 215 to 250%, which is the current statute for eligibility in Minnesota Care. This has a dramatic effect of $129 million. This is a general fund savings in effect because the health care access fund is in deficit. As you know, Mr. Chairman, not only the $111 million, but the $48 million in current statute that says the health care access fund would subsidize the general fund every year. So the effect is on the general fund as well. The next category is benefit eliminations and delays. These are true effects of some benefits that Minnesota citizens would feel effects of. Unless I was asked a specific question, I think the one that is probably the biggest, two biggest ones in there that I will talk about is the disability waiver caps for 1 year. That brings the CADI waiver cap, I believe, to 60, is it not? To 60 new folks per month. Per month would be able to be enrolled in the CADI waiver. This is a community disability services, and the DD waiver cap would exist at 6 new waiver recipients per month for this 1 year period of time. The adult therapy coverage in MA and Minnesota Care, all of these are controversial, Mr. Chairman. This is one of the optional coverages that is not mandated, certainly by MA reimbursement or CMS. It is one that the state had decided that it would provide therapy coverage in both MA and Minnesota Care, and that is being eliminated.
Now, Mr. Commissioner, and that is does not violate the stimulus
maintenance
of effort.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. The there are some mental health case management grants, some reductions, the treatment hours available per person, a small reduction. The, another one that is big and huge is the counting of SSI, Supplemental Social Security Income, for MFIP and the Child Care Assistance Programs. This used to be this way, but over time we have had an add-on feature that we would discount or not include SSI income for that eligibility in MFIP. About 500 families would lose their MFIP eligibility, and others would lose some cash assistance eligibility in the Child Care Assistance Program. The sliding fee grant is a broader subsidy and a sliding fee grant for child care services. About 470 families would lose their eligibility in that. The next one is a whole category of provider payment cuts. These are big numbers. The one is the reduction of CD treatment fund rates by 5%, a rate reduction. This not only includes the private sector, I will remind you that Minnesota has more CD treatment providers per capita than any other state in the nation, of 300 CD treatment facilities throughout the state, six of which are actually state operated, and they would be affected by this 5% reduction as well. The inpatient ratable reduction, it was referred to just a little bit in the previous conversation. This is an ratable reduction. This is unfortunately a familiar item in a budget reduction item, either proposed by the legislature or by the way the governor. 3% reduction is what we thought we could hold that reduction at without adverse infrastructure effect. The other huge number is the continuing care 2.5 provider rate reduction. This is not just nursing facilities, but intermediate care facilities as well. About half of that number it would be nursing facilities. This is accompanied in the governor's announcement about this supplemental budget with a request to repeal the equalization statute, of which Minnesota is one of two states that equalizes the payment of private payers in nursing facilities with public program payment rates as well. We would repeal that legislation to give nursing facilities at least some opportunity to find additional revenue. The other one that is very controversial, of course, is the MERC. This is the Medical Education Research grants that some of them are provided for through the Department of Health. Most of it is provided through the Department of Human Services. This carves out that from the PMAP completely. There would be no MERC payments in this proposal.
What percentage of the MERC payments come from this area?
Oh, it's 90. This must be 90. It is, it's got to be in the high 80 to 90%, Mr. Chairman. Hmm? Well, we'll get you that information.
Funds mainly various residency programs around the state.
That's correct. Eliminate the hospital add-on DRGs for members in Greater Minnesota. I should remind you that there are 16 separate DRG payments, which are to equalize some of those payments for those certain diagnostic reimbursement groups to a metropolitan reimbursement level. That add-on payment for Greater Minnesota hospitals is proposed to be eliminated.
And for the members that they get, I believe, 90% of what the average metro rate is. So this is a big hit on rural hospitals.
Critical access dental, this is also an additional payment that we provide to some dental providers who are deemed to be what is called critical access dental. We do maintain dental coverage, for example, for all MA patients, but the critical access payments to the providers themselves is reduced for that critical access payment level. That is also out of the health care access fund. Mr. Chairman, I'm reminded that this is not a complete elimination, but it is a change of the criteria for what would be an eligible critical access dental provider. Another familiar place is a payment delay or a shift. This is to increase the Minnesota Care managed withhold. The managed care organizations would receive the contracted payment. They would receive it later. And this, by doing it later, it affects a substantial amount of savings. And it also would delay the inpatient hospital rebasing, which is charged to be in effect on January 1st of 2011. This represents a delay in that rebasing for 3 months, which affects the $8.6 million of savings. State-operated services itself, this is the part of the DHS, which is in direct services, would have to have an administrative cut. For an administrative cut in state-operated services generally means a service delivery reduction, and we would there is a complete redesign plan that is being implemented now in contact with over 1,500 stakeholders in the last 2 months, from providers, consumers, families, counties, and that redesign is soon to begin, and that will affect probably the closing of at least one facility in what is called state-operated services. I would remind you that the realm of that state-operated services has got 10 community-based behavioral health hospitals, the Security Hospital, the Anoka Metropolitan Regional Treatment Center, 6 CD treatment facilities, and some behavioral health facilities, one called Mito for adults and one called CABS for adolescent clients in Wilmer. We affect a central office administrative reduction of $11.9 million total. I'm going fast as I can, Mr. Chairman. Speed is probably less important than accuracy. Some additional, I'm going down the list, about the fourth one under what we call transfers or of underspending or surpluses. This was talked about a little bit in Ways and Means Committee last night, Mr. Chairman, that you heard. But in some of the funds that we do manage, a clear one would be the transfer of the CD fund balance to the general fund, this chemical dependency treatment fund. Simply, dollars are not scheduled to be spent out of that fund. At a rate of $4.5 million, we are capturing that surplus, for example. And these are relatively easy things, probably things that we would do whether or not there was a deficit or not, if we were to try to get new savings. The stimulus money, the ARA TANF Emergency Fund refinancing, HHS made it easier for us to use many of the working family credit. This would be similar in other states, what is called subsidized work environment, and made it very easy for us to be claim eligibility for TANF funding to the tune of $28 million. The shift in the HIV funding is one time only. I would remind you this is a surplus. We will take that surplus now. We will pay it back as we traditionally have done at a later time, not to affect the total investment in HIV funding. The The last one I need to give some report on so that we don't have confusion about numbers. The DHS portion of these reductions is $333 million. There's an additional $13.4 million that represents changes in the health care access fund that come from other other agencies, MDH, for example. I think a major portion of that is a $10 million reduction in what is called SHIP, or the State Health Improvement Plan, which came out of the health care access fund, which would affect the same number of savings to constitute $13 million, which would be this 300, add that together, and that's that $346,552,000. Mr. Chairman, that is sort of how this budget proposal looks, and it has these effects and many other effects that I think you will want to hear about in subsequent hearings.
I assume we'll get the more details, but what's the total FTE loss to the Human Services Department?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think we've complete. I would remind you that in some of these, if it talks about that much reduction, for example, of adults without children, and baked into that will be a FTE reduction. Of the administrative cuts alone, we're probably in the 80 to 90 FTE reduction at least, but there will be some more. That would not include FTE savings or reductions, for example, in the SOS administrative reduction or the healthcare operations, Minnesota care operations as well. So it would be something greater than that.
Okay. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming the overview is completed?
Yes.
Okay. Just one question on the provider cuts and the elimination of the equalization. And just so people know, I think it's a good thing for us to consider the elimination of equalization. But I know past efforts have shown that eliminating it or phasing it out would have a fiscal cost because people would spend down to MA levels quicker. But I understand the department is not projecting a fiscal cost with this proposal, and I was wondering why that is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a great question. This is not an immediate elimination for that very reason. This is a 2% rate differential that can occur in the first year, so that we do not have accelerated spend down that would have a fiscal note cost for those who would be able, or a provider would be able to price them into a fast spend-down situation. The second year would be an additional 2% differential, the third year an additional, and on the fourth year, the beginning of the fourth year would be the elimination of the equalization rate statute.
Representative Hyde.
So, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Ludeman, I would assume that in the tails, in you know, year five or year six, there would be a fiscal cost eventually.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I live in at least only a four-year time span. If that exists in the year five, okay, we wouldn't be able to project that far out.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Ludeman, it's good to see you today. Tomorrow, we're hearing more about the child care cuts in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee. I don't know if Assistant Commissioner Johnson is here. But he will be talking with us tomorrow. I wanted to make a comment and then ask you a question. You know, it seems like members, you know, how many times we've been in deficit, but it seems like time and time again, we're going after health, human services and health and human services. And it seems like every time we say we can't do this again, we do it again. And this time the cuts are as deep, if not deeper, than in the past. In childcare, when we look at our families, how to keep our working families working, they need good quality childcare, how to help close that achievement gap. We need our youngest kids in good, high-quality child care. Yet again, we see numerous cuts to the child care program, which last year, your Human Services did not propose. So when we went through this exercise about a year ago, I think, we talked about zero-based budgeting, how decisions are made. And I wondered if you could share with us the philosophy on how the cuts were made and the process you went through. I see some are 5%, and they seem to be sort of straight cuts. We get the underspending now that you're going to capture that because that happened last year. So none of this is necessarily all that new. But how did the governor and you decide what would be cut and by how much?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a good question. I just need to start with the premise that you're understanding that the 28% of all general fund expenditures are DHS expenditures, and all funds, which is more of the picture of this, 39% of all fund expenditures by the state are from DHS. That would tell you that if you're going to solve a budget of this size, that gives you fairly good instruction about where that target would lie. But in the details discussion about it, on how to do it, whether it be a rate reduction at all, and there are many things on that are not on this list that you do not see, that affect, for example, dental coverage for MA was actually a consideration. Thought that that certainly has longer-term impact. So this does bring us closer to what we consider our shorter-term impacts. It does not answer your question about some of the early childhood investments that could result in less stress on the system itself in the longer term. So this is a shorter-term, 16-month budget reduction to affect as much savings as we possibly could.
Mr. Chair,
I represent some
just a quick follow-up. We went through it with Mr. Johnson last year, and he was really very good, Assistant Commissioner Johnson, about talking about how they each had to come up with a certain pot of money, basically out of the different departments, and so it was their role in doing that. Is it basically a 5% that across the board, or was there a percentage that you went by to look for the cuts? It feels like child care is cut disproportionately this time and deeper. So, or was it just you had to come up with the money and this is the way to do it?
Commissioner.
Well, Mr. Chairman, yeah, we had to do it. There's no question about that. It doesn't work quite as easy as on percentages. As you know, the governor talked about a 6% agency reduction plans on grants and programs, for example, a 3% administrative reduction. In general, that's the first kind of format that we would work at. But because we are the bigger program and grant organization, it has certainly effects of almost literally every program that we touch. How to get that right proportionality, even within our own agency? I do this in such a way not to start a war even within DHS. Or controversy, so we talk about it often and early and try to do what we think and keep the infrastructure going as well as it possibly can. So there's not a hard and fast rule about this. It's pretty lifetime budget discussions about this for the last several months.
Next we have Representative Liebling, then we're going to have Abler, Bunn, and Kiffmeyer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had sort of a technical question, and I'm going to pass for now.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple things, and one is I would appreciate, not for today because we don't have enough time to have a good discussion, but not everything, but I'd like a one-page summary of what the spending was we did in 2008-09 after all things got done in 2010-11 after counting if this would happen. And then the projection 2012-13, so we could kind of see, because I've lost all connection to what we're doing and what we used to do. And I don't know if we're spending more or less than 2012-13 than we spent in 2008-09. It would be helpful to me to get that. And so just a one-page summary of major headings even would be helpful, continuing care, et cetera. So.
Mr. Chairman, if I can give you a part of that answer, Representative Abler. After all, you see this list, I think it might be interesting for you to know that in what we call direct appropriations, if this budget proposal was actually put into effect, it would represent about 3.5% increase in spending from the last biennium to this.
All right.
If I use the all funds part of it, that is a higher number, not lower.
All right, but even
do not
so
have the 12-13.
Yeah, but I think staff could put that together. That would be just, I think, productive. And thanks for that short answer. And I have two more things, and Representative Murphy left, but the facility you're closing, can you just give me data how many beds that is so at least people won't worry about closing a treatment center again or something? You're not closing that, obviously. But
closing what, Mr.
Well, the treatment, you're going to close the facility. Would that be like a 10-bed thing or something somewhere? Is that what you're thinking, a small one or not a big one?
It'd be premature for me to say how many beds, but it is certainly not a 200-bed facility like Anoka.
Right.
We have 10 16-bed facilities. Mito is about a 40-bed facility. It won't be Mito. So we're going to have to find a way to It'll be one of our smaller bed facilities.
All right. And
by that, I mean 25 beds or less.
All right. Then.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have three questions. First, a real simple one. In terms of the central office administrative reduction, you alluded to a possible 3% that the governor is asking for. What percentage does this $11.9 million represent?
I need help there. Go ahead. I'm going to ask Jane Rankin, okay. The budget director, for the adjustment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I'm Jane Rankin, the budget director at DHS. The number that you see on the spreadsheet is has an impact at DHS central office of roughly a 5% reduction, but it nets out to a 3% general fund reduction because of how our federal administrative money flows directly into the general fund.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Bunn.
And a second question, Mr. Chair, regarding the critical access dental under provider payments, the last item. In none of the materials I've seen since Monday so far, do we have any language or fiscal note explaining to us what this is and where it comes from? When will we be receiving that information telling us what this is?
Mr. Chairman, good question, Representative Bunn. Tomorrow is when all the budget pages are actually published and would be available to you tomorrow.
Thank you.
And the criteria for the critical access dental would be included in that budget page.
Representative Bunn.
And one last area. In terms of the last item, under benefits elimination, the adult therapy, just so I and others in the room are clear, if we're talking about a MA client here, and also could be either a regular adult MA client or it could be an aged elderly, disabled or blind as well, which are also in this category.
That's correct.
Am I correct in stating that a person in this MA program could receive either a surgery following a car accident or a hip replacement surgery, but not be eligible for any physical therapy afterwards? Is that correct?
I think that's correct. Mr. Chairman, I believe that is what that therapy
Representative Bunn.
Benefit means.
Just to be clear, would this apply to physical therapy both in hospitals and outpatient as well?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to need more help on that.
Oh, you can get back to me on that
if
you can, to
get
clarity on that. Thank you very much.
These are usually outsourced independent therapy centers, so I think I know the answer to the hospital one, but I'm not going to answer it until I get it right. Thank you.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to respond to some extent. I think Representative Abler asked for some information, such as where I was going as well, and I think that will be helpful to all of us. But Representative Slawick, I think in taking a look at some of the cuts, some of the things, I think what I'm reminded of is some of our other hearings where this particular part of the budget was increasing over 20% every biennium, and was in danger of shoving out all other spending in state government, and that we've all had these discussions about the need to kind of rein in the rate of increase, that it was becoming unsustainable. And so I think looking at some of these, we want to make sure they're done fair, and Minnesota people have a tremendous heart of compassion, and I think we're preserving that. But I think just in regards to the fact that unsustainable rate of increase is an issue that we need to deal with is still relevant. I would rather we could maybe choose our process a little bit better, but that's not an option that we have right now. But I think the question of understanding that even with all of this, we're still increasing at 3% when so many others are going down is still something positive to be recognized.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I want to put a little perspective to this with regard to Representative Kiffmeyer's remarks, because, you know, while it's true that there's actual growth in dollars occurring in this area, we have to remember what is causing the growth. And people like to say it is causing the growth. And people like to say, oh, government spending is out of control, you know, as though we're, doing more and more stuff for people, and that's accounting for this growth. And maybe I could just ask the commissioner to talk a little bit about, you know, what is driving that growth? Because my understanding is that, It's part of it is simple population change. Part of it is healthcare costs, which are growing. I mean, this is not, as I'm understanding it, this is not what people think of as, oh, it's just government is somehow, you know, just having fun expanding, right? This is something that is kind of, it's a need that's there. And when we're cutting back, and I'm going to turn it over to you to actually answer that question, Commissioner, but I just want to say that, you know, any way you cut the numbers here, you're kind of telling a different story. And when we talk about the rate of growth in this area, that makes it sound like, you know, somehow we should blame what we provide for people under Health and Human Services. And I'd just like you to explain a little bit, Commissioner, what is driving the growth?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, that's a good question. I think this spreadsheet speaks for itself. It isn't that we're having new services. There are other things driving the cost higher, and you are correct. The four things that I consider as a commissioner about what it is that drives our cost, one of them is administrative complexity. The more programs or the more complex it is, it gets harder to administer. Insurance companies don't do it this way, for example. We do it in a very complex way with a variety of programs. That in itself has an implied higher cost than inflation, for example, itself.
Mr. Chair, if I could just drill down in that a little bit. If you're mentioning four things and you're starting with that one, and if could you just give us an idea of what portion of the growth you think that accounts for? I mean, what's loosely proportionally here?
Of what number? Of 3.5%, for example? It would be a smaller one than the one I'm about to mention.
Okay.
And that is enrollment. So as more people become eligible, you blame the economy, blame the job structure, or whatever you want to talk about. Doesn't matter, but more people become eligible under current law, and that enrollment in itself is the number one driver of our cost, more people covered. We live in the healthcare arena in DHS with MA, and I'm saying that is our core service. Medical assistance is our 585,000 person covered program that is the basic program of which we provide healthcare services for disabled and some elderly folks in this state. The third one is utilization, how people use the system. For example, if they become more chronically troubled or have more of these high episode costs that we are talking about in this GMC, previous GMC discussion, that is a huge cost driver. So how people actually utilize the system, if they feel for whatever reasons that there is more mental health and a deeper episode of mental health, this is cost for how to provide. It means your length of stay is extended, for example, even in state-operated services. The length of stay or utilization is longer at higher cost. And the last one is what you mentioned is medical trend cost, the fixation of many people who are purchasers of health care, whether they be private employers or public program purchasers. When you are told that the capitation rate by actuaries are going to be 5.3% higher, your head sinks, because that means your per episode cost or any payment model that you're using currently means your either managed care or fee-for-service cost is going to be higher. All of those things are answered, actually, partially in this budget proposal. So we can do it in a fee-for-service environment simply by saying ratable reduction going down. Well, that's a very imperfect answer for that. We can talk about complexity with administrative reductions. We can talk about enrollment by eligibility restrictions, and we can answer the utilization issue by making there's one in here about fewer hours available for certain services. So the utilization is also constricted. So we answer all those questions in some portion or another with this supplemental budget, but it does not mean we're having excess services, but we're giving a lot of services to more people, no doubt about it.
Commissioner, when your people come in on the 24th and 25th,
yes.
They probably would do this anyway, but if they start out with saying, what are the fastest growth areas?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, what are what?
The fastest growth
Oh, yes.
Areas, and in terms of percentage that's going to elderly and the percentage that's going to people with disabilities. I mean, both, you add those two together and you got almost your whole budget.
Mr. Chairman, I've told this many times, but I have a few opportunities to say it, but, you know, we are at the end of a 24 or 25-year transition from what was institutional care for disabled Minnesotans to a home and community-based service environment that is the best in the nation. But it is not without cost. So if you looked at our average Medicaid cost per capita, Minnesota would be one of the higher ones, and that is because of its long-term care cost implications, not its acute care cost implications. So you know what I'm talking about.
I would say, however, that we're amongst the lowest states in terms of what we pay for a procedure to a physician.
On average, we're 47th out of 50 states, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chairman.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to kind of finish by paraphrasing sort of what I heard you say, Commissioner, and I appreciate your answer. And what I understand you to be saying is that a lot of the cost increase is really driven by increased need, and both in terms of enrollment and, you know, this is need that's growing, and utilization, you know, a lot of that is need. And the way that the budget addresses that is to simply let those needs go unmet in a lot of cases. And I just want us to be really clear about that. Now, we may be forced to do that, but, you know, let's not pretend that we're, you know, I mean, there are some ways that we've all tried to tackle the complexity issues and so on, and we need to keep on doing that. But what we're doing here is just simply allowing a lot of need to go unmet. And I just think that's a shame. I know we all feel that way.
Representative Bunn gets the final question before we adjourn.
Well, just real quickly, I was going to do a comment with this on the Commissioner's comments about where we are. I've seen a breakdown of that data, the per MA enrollee, and as you said, you called it long-term care, but relative to other states, we appear to be pretty consistent on elderly, regular elderly expenditures, children, and regular adults. That's almost most of the difference is explained by differences in per enrollee disability spending. And as you just said, we've evolved a very high-quality system over many years because of a commitment, a bipartisan commitment to that area. And it's not just utilization. There's more community-based, better for the individuals involved, more humane. But it appears to, at least from a rough look at the data, to have come at a significantly higher cost than many other states. And what we're going to be grappling with in the years ahead is that a sustainable model? How can we sustain that? How can we do it at lower cost? Otherwise, as we've said earlier, more and more other places in the budget will be chopped if we don't. And so it's a really serious challenge. It's you know, embedded in our Minnesota values, and it's going to be a very difficult thing to deal with. So
well
thank
said.
You for your comments.
Commissioner. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner and Ms. Rankin. And members, please save most of the stuff that you got today. Put it in your folder, and I won't get
Put it in the save part.
Meeting is adjourned.